In our first session, we actually covered the first phase of Begin's life from his birth in 1913 until his arrival in Palestine in the spring of 1942. Today, we're going to cover the second phase of Begin's life from his arrival in Palestine in the spring of 42 until May 1948, obviously the creation and the declaration of the independence of the State of Israel. It is going to be for Begin a period of tremendous activity, tremendous energy, and a defining moment in his life. There's going to be only one other period of a number of years, 3, 4, 5 years, where he will do so much, and that will be the period when he becomes prime minister in 1977, to which we'll return a few sessions from now. But as we go through this part of his life, from the spring of 1942 until May 1948 today, try to keep in mind some of the things that we talked about last time, because if you keep them in mind, you'll be able to understand much better the man and the Zionist who's at the heart of the stories that we're going to hear today. Keep in mind the anthem of Beitar and the emphasis on Hadar, or pride, dignity, stature, so to speak, and the importance of revolt in the Beitar anthem. Keep in mind the centrality of the Tanakh in the house in which he grew up, in the Friday night dinners that he recalled with his father, and so on and so forth. And third, obviously, keep in mind the fact that he and Aliza fled the invasion of the Germans into Poland and said that, and then moved east. In other words, here is a man who's also fleeing the Shoah. So there is the notion of Hadar, there's the notion of revolt, there's a centrality of Tanakh, there's the eradication of European Jewry, which he himself didn't actually experience but barely escaped. We're going to see all of that come to pass together, come to have a tremendous influence on who Begin is in this next period of his life. Now, we're going to focus on three particular incidences today. The bombing of the King David Hotel building, the what's called the Sargent's Affair, which we'll talk about obviously soon, and then the Battle at Deir Yassin, which is commonly called the Deir Yassin Massacre, but I'll try to explain a little bit later why that appellation might not be correct. And throughout, as we go through this history from 42 to 48 and talk primarily around these three incidences, what I want to try to do is also weave in what else is happening in the story at large in Palestine and with the drive to create a sovereign Jewish state, so we can see where each of these things fits into the larger story. So as we said, Begin arrives in Palestine in the spring of 1942, April or May. It's really not clear when he arrived. It's important for us to know now, even though we kind of assume that he knew because we know, but he didn't, that he did not have any idea what had happened to his family when he arrived in Palestine. He had left a long time before. He had left Brisk, Warsaw, a long time before. He had been in the army. He had been in jail. He'd been fleeing. And he really had no idea what had happened with his family. So he did what hundreds and thousands of other people in Palestine did back then, which was to go to what was called the Zionist Information Office. And they would get information as best as they could get information, and they would give it out to people who asked based on the location, the age, the people, and so forth. He was told that there was no information available at all about his family, and that was not uncommon. Most people were not able to get information. 4 years later, right after Israel's created, actually, he's going to be in Israel. It's a little bit more than 4 years. He's going to be in Israel. He's going to be in America on a trip, and he's going to meet someone from Brisk who was going to tell him exactly what happened to his family. And as we mentioned last time, his father and his brother were shot in a river. His mother was pulled out of a hospital and killed. And we mentioned last time as well, though he doesn't find that out on this particular trip, that Aliza had one twin sister, and her parents and her twin sister were also killed. Here's what Begin would say years later, about the time in which he found out what had happened to his family. 500 Jews were led one day to the banks of the river Bug near Brisk, Ir Va'em B'Yisrael, a phrase that we talked about last time, a mother city of the Jewish people. My father was among them. He started to sing the song of faith, Ani Ma'amin, on the way, I believe with unbroken faith in the coming of the Mashiach, Ani Ma'amin B'Viyat HaMashiach. He also called on others at the same time that he essentially knew that he was being marched to his death to sing HaTikva. And reports Begin, everybody sang. The Germans pushed them into the river and opened fire on them. The Bug River reddened with the blood of Jews. My father and my teacher, my elderly father, was with them. My mother was hidden in the hospital by a doctor friend who was the hospital's director. One day, all the sick were taken from their bed and slaughtered. My mother was among them. Oyali yitgadal v'yitkadash shemei rabba. And for those who are familiar with the canon of the dirges that are said on Tisha B'Av, the keynote for Tisha B'Av, you know that this phrase Oyali is actually the name of one of the keynote, and it's a phrase that you see over and over again. So even in this small speech, he's quoting the liturgy. He's quoting the liturgy for Tisha B'Av. He's making it very clear who he is and the larger historical Jewish biblical story in which he sees all these events unfolding. Now, one thing that we have to know in order to understand what Begin is going to be doing during these next few years is a little bit about the three paramilitary groups that existed in Palestine at that time. When Begin got there in 1942, there were already three groups in existence. The Haganah was the main one. The Haganah was essentially under the command of David Ben-Gurion. It was the major Jewish paramilitary organization. It tended to have a relatively tame attitude towards the British, a policy of what was called havlaga, restraint, never attacking the British outright, occasionally trying to interfere in something that the British were doing, but primarily defending Jews against Arabs and working on behalf of illegal immigration. We'll come back to the immigration a little bit later today, but as I'm sure many of you know, the British strictly limited Jewish immigration, and the Haganah was very, very deeply involved in many of the photographs that we've seen, the ships coming up to shore, people jumping off the ship, people wading out into the water to bring them in. That was a huge part of the Ma'apilim exercise, which the Haganah was deeply involved in. The Haganah numbered at various times between 40 and 60,000 people. It's a huge organization. The second organization, which Begin is going to come to command, was founded in 1936, essentially by Jabotinsky, which was called the Eitzel, Irgun Tzvai Le'umi, the national army, so to speak. It's founded in 1936, and it will grow slowly, but it will essentially never exceed 5,000 people, and that includes non-combatant support. So in other words, you have the Haganah of 40 to 60,000, you have the Eitzel of 5,000, and then there's a breakaway from the Eitzel in 1940 called the Lehi, Lochemei Chirut Yisrael, which is actually going to be run by the person who will follow Shamir, who will follow Begin as prime minister, and they will number, depending on who you ask, somewhere in the dozens to perhaps 300. So everybody talks about the three paramilitary groups, but in reality, they were very, very different. One that numbered 40 to 60,000, one that numbered 5,000 around, and one that numbered really much, much, much less. And so Begin comes into a Palestine already in which the reality of Jewish paramilitary operations against the British, against the Arabs in favor of immigration is already well underway. Another thing that's really important to understand about Palestine at that time is the sentiment of the Jews in terms of where history was headed. It goes without saying that they knew what was happening in Europe. But how did they feel about what was happening in Palestine? So you have to remember that Churchill, when he was the Secretary of State of the Colonies, gave Transjordan, which was a very big percentage of the mandatory area, to the Hashemites over in Transjordan and created what is today the country of Jordan. We take it again, as a matter of fact, we're obvious that that whole area on the other side of the Jordan River is Transjordan, but the Zionists in Palestine at the time saw it as a huge betrayal. The British had said in 1917, His Majesty's government views with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people. The Zionists assumed, okay, the area of the mandate is going to become ours. And Churchill in the 20s gives it over to the Hashemites, and what's left of Palestine is much less than there had been before. Then in 1937, the British appoint a commission to try to decide what to do with Palestine since the violence between Arabs and Jews was getting to be so serious, and it was called the Peel Commission. And the Peel Commission came back and suggested for the first time something that, again, today to us sounds like an obvious suggestion, which was to divide the land. Peel, they came out with a map, and the Peel map was a little bit unrealistic for the Jews. The territory was ridiculous. But nonetheless, as one might expect, the Jews of the Yishuv voted for it, and it was officially approved at the 20th Zionist Congress. But Peel had also raised another issue which would become crucial, And that other issue was that it was going to limit Jewish immigration to 12,000 Jews a year for 5 years. Remember, as Europe is beginning to burn. So 1937, nobody quite knows exactly how horrible Europe is going to get, but it's very clear that things are heating up and there's a limit on immigration. The other thing to remember about that limit on immigration beyond what is happening in Europe was that you can't build a country out of 60 or 70,000 people. You can't build a country out of 100,000 people. If the drive here was to create a Jewish sovereign state, then the British limitation on immigration was essentially a revocation of the Balfour Declaration. The British never came out and said, we're doing away with Balfour, but if you're going to limit immigration to such a low level, what you're essentially saying is we're going to make sure you don't have the people necessary to make the country that you're trying to build. In 1939, still, of course, Begin is not in Palestine yet, the MacDonald White Paper said specifically that it was no longer British policy that Palestine should become a Jewish state. And at that point, Ben-Gurion came out with his very famous phrase, we're going to fight the Nazis as if there were no white paper, and we're going to fight the white paper as if there were no war. Because on one hand, obviously, the British are the enemy in Palestine, but elsewhere in the world, in the European theater, of course, the British are the allies of the free world and of the Jews. And that very famous phrase by Ben-Gurion was, we're really going to separate. When it comes to Europe, we're going to try to aid and abet the Brits as best as we can to try to help whatever can be saved of European Jewry. Here in Palestine, we're simply going to fight the British. When I was working on my biography of Begin a number of years ago, I interviewed the person who was really his right-hand man for most of his career, a man named Yechiel Kadishai. Kadishai met Begin in 1942, and it's a story that he loved to tell, but I asked him to tell it to me again so I could hear it directly from him. And he said that he had actually joined the Jewish Legion of the British Army because that's what the Yeshuv was encouraging Jews to do. The idea was, if we fight for the British now, then when the war has concluded, the British will remember that positively, and it might help us out when it comes time to build a state. So Kadishai, who had grown up from a very, very, very early age in Palestine, joins the Jewish Legion, ends up being assigned to guarding a warehouse, not terribly interesting, he said, in Ismailia, which is in Egypt. But there were trains running back and forth between Ismailia, and he told me that before he went down to Ismailia the first time, they heard a rumor in the Yeshuv, which was that the Germans were going to try to wipe out Polish Jewry. And he told me, with a pained look on his face, he said, they laughed. The 20-year-old, 19-year-old, 21-year-olds, the Jews in Tel Aviv, when they heard that, they laughed. They said, what do you mean he's going to wipe out Polish Jewry? There's 3 million Polish Jews. You can't kill 3 million people. Well, it turns out that you can. And in 1942, Kadishai told me, he got a leave for about 3 days, a furlough of 3 days, to go back to Palestine from Europe, from Egypt, just a quick little train ride. And he went back to Tel Aviv. And he's with his friends, and he's circulating around Tel Aviv, which is still a very young city at that time. And the rumor about Hitler trying to destroy Polish Jewry is still circulating. But now it's circulating not as something impossible to imagine. Now it really sounds like Hitler is in the process of eradicating Polish Jewry. And we need to recall, of course, that Poland was the crown jewel community of the Jewish world. For 600 years, it had been the place in all of the world where the Jews had thrived for the longest and in the greatest numbers, and so on and so forth. Kadishai told me that a group of young people in their late teens and their early 20s, really very young, got together in a building to try to talk about what can they possibly do to stop the British destruction of European Jewry, certainly to try to help Polish Jewry. Now, obviously, there is something a little bit naive about that meeting. What are a bunch of young men in Palestine going to do to stop the Nazi onslaught in Poland? But the meeting did take place. And Kadishai told me that towards the end of the meeting, a guy who they'd never seen before stood up in a khaki uniform, which happened to be the uniform of the Polish Free Army, and he said with a kind of extraordinary presence, if you want to actually help the Jews of Europe, what you need to do is attack the British in Palestine. Because the Jews of Europe know there's nowhere to run. The shores of America are closed. The shores of Canada are closed. Europe is a fire. Australia is too far for the vast majority of people. If you want to help European Jews, give them a reason to flee. And the only reason they'll have a reason to flee is if they have at least a faint hope of getting into Palestine. And the only way to allow Jews into Palestine is going to be to get the British to change their policy. And the only way to get the British to change their policy is going to be to attack the British in Palestine. And he sat down. The meeting ended a short while later, and as people are filing out, Kadishai said to somebody, "Who was that guy?" And the person said to him, "Oh, he used to be the head of Beitar in Poland, and he was imprisoned by the Russians. He just got here. The name is Begin." And it's kind of chilling to think about that meeting and to realize what that "the name is Begin" was going to eventually mean for Jewish history and Israeli history. But Kadishai loved to tell that story. Begin gets out of the Polish Free Army at the beginning of 1944, at the end of January 1944. The head of the Irgun had been killed. David Raziel had been killed in Iraq in a mission that had gone bad not that long before. And though there had been an interim leader, the Irgun desperately needed a leader. Begin was approached. By this point, his name is pretty well known. His former position as the head of Beitar is very well known. He's been given advice and so forth. He takes the lead of the Irgun the day after he exits the Polish Free Army. And with that, and here again, keep in mind the revolt, and the revolt as a theme of the Beitar anthem. Here's what Begin says, obviously, to the British. "We are nearing the final stage of the war. We are facing a decision that will change the fate of generations to come. The ceasefire announced at the beginning of World War II, the ceasefire between the British and the Yishuv, has been broken by the British. The rulers of our land, i.e. the British, did not take loyalty, concessions, or sacrifices into account. They have fulfilled and are still moving forward with their plan, the elimination of national Zionism. We will draw our conclusions fearlessly. No more ceasefire in the land of Israel between the people and the Hebrew youth and the British administration, which hands over our brothers to Hitler." It's important to remember that that was not hyperbole, because when the British did not allow ships to come ashore, some of those ships ended up going right back to Europe. The Exodus is the most famous, but there are others as well. So what Begin says basically is the ceasefire is over, and notice his reference to Hebrew youth. Not the Jewish youth, not the Zionist youth, but Hebrew youth. This is really kind of the rebirth of an ancient biblical story. So Begin declares the revolt and is immediately declared by the British terrorist number one. There are photographs of him on these wanted posters where he's the number one wanted person. The British offer a £10,000 reward for his capture, which is roughly equivalent to about $500,000 today. And he therefore, of course, has to go into hiding. We're not going to spend a tremendous amount of time about the period in which he was hiding. He was underground for just a little bit, around 4 years, from February 1944 to April 1948, so a little bit more than 4 years. Two or three things we should mention quickly about his being in hiding, and he moved around a great deal. One of them was that one of his main disguises was as a man named Rabbi Sassover, and he grew a beard. There are pictures of him online you can find of him being this rabbi, and Aliza's dressed up as a Rebbetzin, and Benny, who's already a little boy, is with them. He totally looks the part, but he also acted the part. He gave shiurim in shuls. He was not a person who could have been a Rosh Yeshiva, a person who would lead a great yeshiva. He wasn't that kind of a scholar, but he knew a lot. And he could therefore give shiurim on Shabbat and so on and so forth, which he did. And it's during this period that his daughter Chasya was born and named after Begin's mother. Dr. Yonah Kingshofer, whoever he was, made the big mistake of leaving his passport in a public library. Begin somehow got a hold of that passport, and when the Sassover disguise was beginning to wear thin, they moved and he assumed that name. It was during that period that Leah, their third child, who was named after Aliza's twin sister, was born. And Begin stays in hiding, moving around, knowing full well that if he is captured by the British, he is likely to be executed. It wasn't just a game of cat and mouse. It was very serious business. And of course, he's running the Irgun the entire time. It's no small accomplishment. Benny Begin, many years later, when he was asked what was the hardest part of being in hiding, because he was already a boy old enough to know that they couldn't really say very much, he said, kind of very sadly, that when his father came out of hiding in April 1948, the most horrible thing that happened to him was that he found out that this terrible guy, Begin, that everybody was talking about was his father. He actually had no idea that that was their family name. And obviously, while in the Irgun world, Begin was glorified, in much of the rest of Palestine, that was hardly the case. Things begin to heat up between the various underground groups. In November 1944, the Lehi kills Lord Moyne in Cairo. He was the British resident minister in Cairo. The Irgun had nothing to do with it at all, but it is a huge move to kill a British diplomat of sorts in Cairo. And Ben-Gurion is very worried that this is going to set the British after the Yishuv. And therefore, there is what's called the Saison, a period of 4 months from November 44 through March 1945, in which basically the Haganah is going to hunt down members of the Irgun and members of the Lehi, confiscate their weapons, sabotage their operations, take paperwork, and so on and so forth. So things are heating up among the Jews as well. And then Churchill is defeated in July of 1945, and Clement Attlee, of course, replaces him. And Attlee was as problematic as Churchill was for the Zionists, no question. Attlee was much worse. So the Yishuv sees things beginning to shift badly. There is very bitter relationships inside the Jewish organizations. The attitude of the British seems likely to change. And therefore, the three paramilitary organizations, the Haganah, the Irgun, and the Lehi, all bind together in October 1945 and create what's called Tnuat HaMeri HaIvri, the Jewish resistance movement. They do all kinds of operations together. In November, they blow up a tremendous number of railways all across Palestine. In June 1946, they coordinate 11 attacks on bridges all across Palestine. They caused a tremendous amount of damage with the destruction of these 11 bridges in the middle of June 1946. And the British decide that this is really getting out of control. This united Jewish front is causing a tremendous amount of damage. It's also very demoralizing to the British soldiers in Palestine. So the British decide to take matters into their own hand. And about 2 weeks later, on Saturday, June 29th, 1946, what they called Operation Agatha, but what the Zionist community has always called HaShabbat HaShchora, the Black Sabbath, the British took 17,000 British soldiers in Palestine, arrested 2,700 people from the underground, all of the movements, and confiscated a tremendous number of documents. That's June 29th, 1946. 2 days later, July 1st, Moshe Sneh, who's the head of the Haganah, sends a note to Begin authorizing what will become one of Begin's most well-known operations, the bombing of the King David Hotel building. So again, the Black Sabbath is on June 29th. Just 2 days later, on July 1st, the Haganah gives Begin explicit approval to go ahead and bomb the King David building. And therefore, then we move into the events of July 1946 and the King David. Now, why was the King David Hotel building important? And I'm going to try to be careful to call it either the King David or the King David Hotel building and not the King David Hotel, because it was not really functioning as a hotel at that point. There were some rooms that were being leased out to people, but fundamentally what the King David Hotel building was at that point was the command center of the British and a place where many officers were housed, offices were kept, and so on and so forth. And the underground knew that the British had taken an enormous percentage of the documents that they had collected on Black Sabbath, and they had taken them and were storing them in the King David Hotel building. And these documents were, of course, going to be used to arrest, convict, possibly even execute leadership of the Jewish Yishuv. They could have possibly executed Ben-Gurion. They could have certainly indicted Golda Meir. There were many people whose names become instrumental in the creation of the Jewish state, who, if this had been allowed to go forward, really could have been arrested. And that's why the progress was so fast. Shabbat HaShchora is June 29th, and already on July 1st, the Haganah gives Begin the go-ahead. And the plan was as such. They were able to discover that the King David got its daily milk supply in enormous metal canisters that were actually supplied by local Arabs. And by posing as dating couples who were going into the King David In and Out, they were able to snoop around, and they saw that the milk was delivered on a certain side area, and that the hotel seemed to be held up, at least on the southern end, by a number of pillars and columns. And so they decided that's where they were going to try to blow up the building. The plan, by the way, was at the meantime that the Lehi was also going to carry out a parallel attack on what was called the David Brothers building. The address there is 38 Keren HaYesod, which is where today Jabotinsky and King David Street meet. For those of you who are Jerusalemites or frequent Jerusalem regularly, it's where Bardak Pizza is. But it was then one of the tallest buildings in Jerusalem, a kind of also a building that the British were using, some notoriety. So the idea was that the Irgun's going to blow up the hotel, destroy all the documentation. The Lehi's going to blow up this other very symbolic building, and then they're going to make a point to the British. Now the question becomes, how do you blow up the documents and not kill lots of people in the building? So the question became, how much time in advance should we give them warning? If we give them no warning, we're going to kill a lot of people. So we have to give them plenty of warning. But if we give them plenty of warning, then of course they can start taking boxes of documents out, and that will undermine the whole purpose of the operation. Some people have suggested 45 minutes, some people wanted 20. In the end, they settled on 30 minutes, and it was scheduled for July 19th. It's scheduled for July 19th, but on the 17th, the Haganah, which was not going to play a role but had authorized the attack, asked for a delay. Begin didn't know why they'd asked for a delay, but he agreed to it. It turns out, we found out later, that Chaim Weizmann had gotten wind of this operation being planned, and he understood that if the underground attacked the British headquarters in Palestine, that was going to be the end. And Chaim Weizmann was still, as we said last time, very much loyal to the British in a lot of ways. He'd been instrumental in getting the Balfour Declaration and so forth, and it was very hard for him to acknowledge that the British had really become the enemy. He wanted it delayed so that they could try to perhaps get people to agree not to do it. Three more delays were requested. Begin granted all of them, and it was moved finally to July 22nd, and Begin agreed to that. But on the morning of July 22nd, they asked for another delay, and Begin did not even bother responding to it. He's, of course, in hiding. He's running the operation from afar. And exactly as planned, calls are made to the French consulate, which was next door, to the central switchboard of the King David, and to the Palestine post. All three calls were answered. All three were given a warning that in 30 minutes, the hotel building is going to be blown up. And every single office simply ignored the warning. The bomb went off. It was equivalent to a 500-kilo aerial bomb, which is an enormous amount of bombs. And Begin is in hiding, listening to the reports on the radio, and it becomes clear very, very quickly that an enormous number of people had been killed in the bombing. He begins to get so physically distraught that Chaim Landau, who will eventually become a political partner of his, actually worries that he's going to have a heart attack. And he pulls a tube out of the back of the radio. Younger people in our audience probably know what a radio is, but may not know that radios used to have tubes, but they did. So he pulled a tube out and the radio went silent. But Begin, of course, got the information eventually. 92 people were killed in the attack, 28 British, 42 Arabs, 17 Jews, including one member of the Irgun who had not gotten out in time after placing the armaments, two Armenians, a Russian, a Greek, and so forth. You can imagine the response of the British. You can imagine the response of the world. And therefore, in what will become a pattern that will repeat itself time and again, Ben-Gurion and the Haganah come out in absolute, they're aghast. They cannot believe that this was done. They deny absolutely any knowledge of the operation whatsoever. Now, we know that Sneh had actually given the go-ahead specifically to Begin on July 1st, but it made no difference. Ben-Gurion denied left and right and up and down that he or the Haganah had anything to do with it, and that is a pattern that we will see unfolding throughout the career between the two men. Whatever Begin's reputation might have been prior to the bombing of the King David, now he is known throughout the world as the terrorist who attacked the British, killed lots of British people, lots of innocent people, and so on and so forth. After this, by the way, the Haganah basically stops cooperating with either of the other two groups, and it basically does two things. It provides the British with intelligence, and it also tries to get intelligence about the British, and it works on behalf of illegal immigration, the Ma'apilim, but it's out of the military operation. Was the bombing a success? Well, on a certain level, of course, Begin was distraught about what happened. The documentation was destroyed, so in that regard, it was a success. And perhaps even more importantly, 7 months after the bombing, the British announced that they were leaving Palestine. And it's important for us to understand why that worked and how that worked. Today, when we go down Jerusalem, you can just drive down King David Street and you pass the King David on the right and the YMCA on the left, and then you pass Hebrew Union College, and then you go to one hotel, and then you come to Mamila Hotel, then you're at the mall. It just seems perfectly natural. But back then, it was a highly controlled area with rings and rings and rings of protection, barbed wire and guards and sentries, kind of like a green zone in Iraq for the Americans. And if you could penetrate that, you could penetrate anything in Palestine. And British mothers understood that. When the Irgun blew up the King David, what every British mother who had a kid serving in Palestine understood was, it doesn't really matter what the Prime Minister says. I now know that that my government cannot keep my kids safe. Many of us who know the history of the changing American attitude towards the Vietnam War know that it was only after American media started showing the dozens and then hundreds of coffins coming into Dover Air Force Base, where they were coming in from Vietnam, it was then that popular opinion about the war really began to shift very dramatically. You get into the hearts and minds and souls and worry of mothers and fathers, and you will change the opinion of people. It's how it worked, by the way, in the Lebanon war here in Israel with the four mothers, which we'll come back to a little bit later down the road in our series. But in any event, the position of the British becomes very different. They announce, as I said, 7 months after the attack that they are leaving Palestine. 9 months after that, the UN in November 47 votes to create a Jewish state. And then a few months later in May of 1948, basically 2 years, a little bit less, after the bombing, the Union Jack comes down and David Ben-Gurion will declare the State of Israel in Tel Aviv. But we can't go right to independence yet. There are two more events that are really going to solidify Begin's reputation internationally, but also among Jews in the Yeshuv, that it's critically important that we cover. The first is what was called the incident of the British sergeants. And to understand this, we have to know that the British had, for a very long time, by the time Begin comes to Palestine, hanging and flogging Jews for all kinds of various infractions. The British flogged people, whipped them across the empire in India and in Egypt and everywhere as a way of humiliating them. Flogging was a punishment for a simple thief. And so if you took somebody who saw himself or herself as being a political operative or a nationalist fighter and you flogged them, in addition to causing them a lot of pain, what you were saying is, you're not anything important. You're just a common thief, and that's how we're going to treat you. And of course, when Jews were involved in things that had to do with arms, the British were more than willing to hang people as necessary. And they hung a young man named Shlomo ben Yosef in 1938, who went to the gallows, by the way, singing the Beitar anthem. So from our experience of reading it last week, it gives you a little bit of a sense of what he was talking about. That's 38. That's early on. It's long before Begin is going to get to Palestine. It's long before the Nazi assault on the Jews is going to reach full volume. But that's already becoming part of the picture. But by March 1946, now we're fast forwarding, Begin is very much in Palestine. Begin is in charge of the Irgun. And the Irgun attacks a British base called Sarafund, which is today called Srifin. The Israeli IDF base with Srifi Aleph and Bet is based on the British name of Sarafand, and it's about 12 miles south of Tel Aviv. They raided it to get arms, they raided arms depot and so forth. They did a lot of damage, and of course there was a huge insult to the British capacity because they also attacked an army base and did so successfully. And the British captured two members of the Irgun who were involved in the attack, Michael Ashbel and Yosef Simchon. They were captured, and after 5 days, they were sentenced to death. 5 days after that, the Etzel captures 5 British soldiers. And Begin makes it very clear. If you kill those two people, we will execute your soldiers. And the British didn't know quite how seriously to take Begin, but of course they understood that he meant business at this point. and they decided to commute the sentence. And Begin, from that period, already back in March 1946, had learned something very clear. Number one, his small band of fighters, his 5,000 people, 4,000 people, relative to the 40 to 60,000 that the Haganah had, his small band could actually get the British Empire to change its mind. They had sentenced these two guys who were unquestionably guilty of what the British said they had done. He had gotten them to commute their sentences. Begin learned, we can actually change the policy of the British Empire. And the second one was that Hadar had ended the conflict. Begin was saying, these are national fighters. You are not going to hang them also like common criminals. It's not going to happen. Hadar is going to come to the fore a few months later, at the end of the year, in December 27th, when a 16-year-old kid, Benjamin Kimchi, was sentenced to 18 lashes for robbing a bank. The Irgun robbed lots of banks, both because it needed money and because it saw the tax money that the British had collected as being illegally collected, since it saw the British presence in Palestine as fundamentally illegitimate. So they robbed banks left and right for money that they needed for their operations. And Kimchi was caught, and he was sentenced, as I said, to 18 lashes. And Begin issued an ultimatum. Again, remember Hadar, remember flogging, remember the common criminal. As far as Begin was concerned, a 16-year-old kid doesn't get flogged no matter what, first of all. And second of all, you're not going to do that to a member of the Irgun. The British decided, and they flogged him 18 times. The Etzel went out, and it captured a British major in Netanya who was sitting with his wife. They took him away to a place a little bit far away from there. They stripped him down to his underwear. They flogged him 18 times, exactly the same number of times, brought him back to his wife, still in his underwear, and deposited him. And in Tel Aviv, two other British sergeants were both also captured, each lashed 18 times. And Begin said as follows in a public address to the British: as we had warned, and as a reaction to the barbaric act of these oppressors, British officers were flagged on Sunday, Vav Tevet, notice the date, this is the Hebrew rebellion, in Netanya, the place of the last British pogrom, a British pogrom. You're no better or worse, but certainly no better than what was going on in Europe. We now warn, if the oppressors dare to injure the body or the person or the national honor, Hadar, of young Hebrews, not Jews, Hebrews, we will not respond with the whip, we will respond with fire. Brits back home were enraged. Synagogue was burnt in London. There were all kinds of attacks on Jews in England. But the British never again flogged another Jew or Arab in Palestine. And the calls begin from England to start pulling back from Palestine because of that. And of course, it's going to only become more important as when the King David Hotel thing happens. In 1946, Dov Gruner is caught stealing weapons at a police station in April 1946. He's actually shot in the face during the attack, and he's captured, and he's sentenced to death. He survives the wound, and he's sentenced to death. And as a result of that, Begin had already learned, all you got to do is grab a British soldier and tell them not to execute somebody, and we're going to be able to make this into a draw. So the Etzel grabbed a British officer and a British judge, both pretty high-ranking people, and the British postponed the execution, so to speak, and the Etzel released its prisoners. Later that month, by the way, we're just going to not talk about this right now a lot, but just remember these names, please, for later on in our discussions. Mayor Feinstein of the Etzel and Moshe Barazani of the Lehi, who are in British prison and also sentenced to die for something that had happened much earlier, blow themselves up the night before they are supposed to be hanged. The reason they did that was because they had planned to try to blow themselves up with a grenade that had been smuggled in as they were actually going to the gallows so they'd be able to kill the hangman. But the day before, the rabbi who serviced the prison came to them and told them not to worry, that he would be with them as they were hanged, and they knew that they couldn't kill him. So they blew themselves up in their cell singing Adon Olam. They sang loud enough so that the entire prison could hear. Don't forget the last line of Adon Olam, V'im Ruchi Gviati, right, with my spirit and my body. That's how I reach out to God. They blew themselves up, and we'll come back in a few sessions into why Feinstein and Barazani are going to be critically important people for Begin. Now we're going to move to the next month. Very quickly, we're going to get through this. In May 1947, so we are about a month after the previous incident of April that we talked about, the HL conduct an amazingly daring raid on a British prison in Akko. There's a lot of members of the Jewish underground being held there. The Etzel had exact lists of who it wanted to free and who it was going to take and so on and so forth. They blasted through the gates. It was an excellently executed operation almost until the end. Two things went wrong with the very end of the operation, which was a huge humiliation for the British eventually. One was that British soldiers were actually bathing in the Mediterranean on the beach just south of Akko, and they heard the explosions, and they realized that something was up. So even though they weren't technically on duty at the prison, they had their arms with them, and they quickly got dressed, and they grabbed their arms, and they went to the highway, and they were able to block some of the people that were from the Etzel who were fleeing. More importantly and more tragically, Avshalom Chaviv, Meir Nakar, and Yaakov Weiss, three people who were in the Etzel, did not hear the signal to board the truck and to get ready to leave the prison, and they were left behind. And they were, of course, needless to say, sentenced to death by hanging. Now, this is on May 4th, just to give you a sense of where things are. On May 15th of 1947, just a couple weeks later, basically, UNSCOP, the United Nations Special Commission on Palestine, is going to be created. So the international momentum is moving towards the creation of a Jewish state. The British have also said, I've already said now, of course, we're out, we're turning this over to the UN. But in the meantime, though, Begin is not going to wait for the establishment of a Jewish state. He's got these three soldiers that he has to somehow save. And what they try to do, of course, is to capture two more British soldiers that they can then hold ransom, so to speak. It's very hard. The British have told their men not to go out in uniform. They've told their men to try to not go out at all. They've told their men never to go out by themselves. And the Etzel looks high and low, far and wide, to try to find some British soldiers to kidnap. And eventually, it finds two, but it's not what they wanted. On July 12th, they capture two sergeants, Clifford Martin and Mervyn Pace. This was a bad stroke of luck for the Etzel. Martin's mother was Jewish, and Pace was deeply sympathetic to the Zionists and had actually been helpful to the Haganah. And they were only sergeants. They weren't a judge, they weren't majors, they weren't high-ranking officers of any sort. So quite frankly, the British didn't care nearly as much as they cared about the others. And for 12 days, Netanya is simply a ghost town. The British are looking everywhere they possibly can for these men, assuming that they were in Netanya where they had been nabbed. But they were being kept in a bunker, and it was not pleasant. They were in a bunker that was 3 cubic meters with no light at all, minimal air, and a roof covered with a meter of sand to stifle noise, a bucket for use as a toilet. And they were in there, as we said, for 12 days. Now, while the British are looking for these soldiers, yet another event, which Begin's not involved in, but I'll just mention it so we can see how all the pieces fit together. The Exodus arrives in Haifa on July 25th, 1947. Now, we tend to think Paul Newman when we think Exodus, right? A great story of a ship with 4,000 people coming to Palestine. The Exodus was a disastrous story for the Jews in the Yishuv for many reasons. First of all, the British boarded the ship before it reached shore and killed some members of the staff there. Bill Bernstein, who was a Machal volunteer, was actually clubbed to death by British soldiers on the ship. A couple of others were killed by gunshot wounds. And eventually, of course, the Exodus docks at the end of July, but it's sent back to Europe, as of course most people know. And a few days after that, on July 29th, 1947, the British decide we're going forward. And they hang Weiss, Chaviv, and Nakar. Now Begin understands that the capture of the two British sergeants is not going to save the lives of those three Jews. The lives of those three Jews are over. The question is, what is he going to do? And the day after that, the bodies of the two British sergeants are found hanging from a tree with a note from the Etzel saying that they had been executed and the clearing where they were found had also been mined, so that one of the British officers who was taking them down was also hurt. And here is what Colonel Nicol Gray, the Inspector General of the Palestine Police Force, remembered years later about that moment. He said, "We could have gotten over losses of life or property, But the empire cannot withstand blows to prestige and the floggings, the Acre prison break-in, and the hanging of the sergeants. These were blows to prestige. The first one made a joke out of us. The second, which took on a symbolic importance similar to the fall of the Bastille, underscored that we were no longer capable of ensuring law and order in the land, and the hangings set us, the rulers, on the same exact level of authority as them, the terrorists. One can only imagine the reaction of the Jewish world in America, in the Yeshuv, in Europe, to the hanging of the sergeants after it was clear that they were not going to be able to save, the HL was not going to be able to save the other three people. And it led to tremendous outrage. And if anything, that was what got Menachem Begin branded as a terrorist. Many, many years later, in 1991, shortly before his death, actually, he gives a long interview to Israeli television. And he is asked, what do you think about that act in retrospect? And interestingly enough, he said, it was a brutal act. And then he paused and he said, and after that brutal act, there were no more hangings of Jews in Palestine. So he wasn't exactly remorseful. He was fully aware of the enormous human complexity of a decision like that. But the act was taken and Begin bore the brunt of that responsibility and that reputation for a very long time. On August 31st, a month later, UNSCOP issues its report saying that it wants to divide the land of Israel into two states. Everyone knows the story of the vote in the UN. And essentially at that point, the war begins. And the war begins as an informal war between kind of undisciplined Jordanian fighters mostly. And on May 14th, 48, will become a much more formal war between five states and the newly declared state of Israel. But now we're still before the war. We're in March 48. It's after the UN vote, so the war is already underway, but it's before May 14th, 1948, so it's not yet the formal part of the war. But Jerusalem is suffering terribly. It's cut off from food, from supplies, from medicine, certainly from ammunition. And just to give you an example of how hard it was to get to Jerusalem, you know, those of us who go to Jerusalem today, especially now because the highways have been widened, forget what the road to Jerusalem used to be like. We don't even remember what it was like just a couple of years ago when the highway was much narrower and curvier than it is. But I remember as a kid here in Israel in the late 60s, that road was really a winding serpentine road, and that was even bigger than it was in the 40s. So in March 48, for example, 136 supply trucks tried to reach Jerusalem, and only 41 succeeded, meaning just more than 25% of the trucks that are sent through made it in. And we understand what that means. It's the loss of the ammunition, the loss of the food, and in almost all cases, the loss of the personnel in those trucks as well. And although they're now on the side of the road, when I was growing up in Israel many, many years ago, those trucks were actually in the middle. The lanes going north and lanes going south, or at a different point going east and going west, were separated by a kind of an island, and those burnt out trucks were actually situated there. Many fewer remain, and they're off on the side with some spotlights as a kind of a testimony, but back then they were simply left on the road where they were hit by whatever they were hit with and burnt out. And it was a constant reminder to me as a young kid that the simple act of driving into Jerusalem was nothing that could be taken for granted. So the battle for Jerusalem is becoming fierce. Jerusalem is in desperate straits. There's a very famous battle with the Haganah for Jerusalem on April 7th and 8th in a place called the Castel, which is near Mivaseret Tzion, not too far from Har Herzl and Ein Karem. The way we drive, those things seem like very different parts of the city. But if you actually go to Google Maps and just look for the Castel, it's actually a national park. So just put in Castel National Park and then just slide over to the right a little bit. You'll see Ein Karem, you'll see Mount Herzl. It's really very small distances. The Eitzel decides, again, with the Haganah's knowledge and approval, that it should capture Dir Yassin, which is a small village not too far in from the Castel. It's not clear 100% why they thought that they needed to capture the Castel. One view is that they thought the Castel could be used as a launching pad for Arab operations to then try to defend, the Dir Yassin could be used as a launching pad to try to defend the Castel. Another argument was that there was an open area near Dir Yassin which might have been used as a kind of a short runway. It's, by the way, where the Jerusalem neighborhood of Har Nof is today, so you want to know where that is. And they decide, along with the Lehi, to send troops in and to empty Dir Yassin out of its population. The soldiers are not terribly well trained, but they are told you're not going to hit any resistance. The people basically are pretty docile. Just go in there with a truck with loudspeakers, announce to them that you're here to clear the village out, and people will leave and you'll take over the town. Needless to say, nothing went the way it was supposed to. And to wrap things very quick, they go in at 4:30 in the morning, the Lehi from one side, the Irgun from the other side. Their communications equipment dies almost the minute that the operation starts. So now the Lehi and the Irgun can't communicate, don't know what each is doing. The truck that has the loudspeaker, which is supposed to warn the residents of the village to leave, falls into a tank trap that had been dug very deep. It had been dug because they actually knew that the Jewish forces were coming. There had been some leak of information and they were prepared. And these young, inexperienced soldiers encountered a tremendous amount of resistance. A lot of houses were blown up, grenades were thrown into houses. And when I wrote this book about Begin, I don't know, 6, 7, 8 years ago, whenever it was, that was the prevailing story. The prevailing story, even among the Zionist camps, was that these were men who were not very well trained. They panicked. They threw grenades in. And the only area in which there was really controversy was how many people were killed. Needless to say, there were rumors that were completely false about rapes, about mutilations of bodies, eyes gouged out, arms and legs chopped off. That was, of course, everybody on the Jewish side knew that that was absurd and that had not happened. But there were lots of claims, including from members of the Haganah who got to Deir Yassin that night and were appalled by what they saw, that there were hundreds of dead, 240, something around that. Begin said, it can't be, it's impossible. There were closer to 100. Now, it's very important for us to understand, because this will have an enormous impact on Israel's history. Every single character in that show, so to speak, has a vested interest in exaggerating the number of dead. Everybody does. The Arabs have a vested interest in because they want to try to get international sympathy. And they want to try to get other Arab countries to support them in saying, look what these Jews will do. I mean, they come into our village, look what they do. So the Arabs have a vested interest in inflating the numbers. So, of course, does the Haganah. The Haganah has a vested interest because they want to make Begin and the Irgun, and of course the Lehi as well, look terrible, look like monsters. So they have that agenda. And the Lehi and the Irgun, interestingly enough, also have an agenda, even though they actually do say what the number was. They're not terribly upset that the number that's inflated is being used, because they understand that Arab panic is going to be critical to getting a large number of Arabs to leave the land of Israel during the war. And this is a very controversial and very painful part of the birth of the State of Israel. But as historian Benny Morris, who is certainly was at one point one of what's called the new historians in Israel and certainly part of the left at that point in his life, said, Ben-Gurion understood that the way the population balance was, there was no way that a Jewish state was going to be able to survive, and that you had to have a much bigger Jewish demographic majority, and therefore you had to do whatever you could do to convince the Arabs to leave. Now, as we all know, there's a tremendous amount of debate. Were they pushed out? Were they scared out? Were they forced out? And it's very complicated. The answer is some of each. But again, the incentive for the undergrounds to inflate the numbers was for the Arabs across Palestine to be scared. And interestingly enough, in the early 1990s, some historians did some research talking both to the families of those who'd left who were now in refugee camps far away and those who'd stayed in Israel but had thought about leaving. What was it that made you either leave or think about leaving? And an overwhelming number said Deir Yassin. When we heard what had happened there, we got really scared of what the Jews might do to us. But since I wrote the book, a well-known Israeli historian at Bar-Ilan University named Eliezer Tauber, who speaks English and Hebrew and Arabic, and got access to all kinds of documentation, including documentation that was held by the Palestinian Authority. How we got that documentation, he's never completely explained, but it must have been quite something. But he did something really extraordinary. He compared the testimonies of all of the people, and there were hundreds and hundreds of them. There were about 1,000 people in the village, 700 fled, and we'll see what happened to the others in a moment. He was able to kind of triangulate all of the various testimonies and say, oh, the person mentioned here is actually what was mentioned there because of where the house was described, or somebody putting a flag here, or somebody doing whatever. He was able, with one or two exceptions, to identify the circumstances in which every single person who was killed was killed. And he argues, I think fairly convincingly, that about 100 people were killed, that about 90-something of them were either combatants or people involved with combatants. So for example, if a person was firing shells out of a house in a room in which his children were situated, And the Jewish forces responded by lobbing something through the window to take out his gun. It's true, children were killed. But Talbert would argue that the word massacre does not belong to that. And I think there's a fairly good case that can be made. But in any event, where the cutting edge research seems to be these days is that about 100 were killed, 200 were captured. And Talbert points out quite rightly that if the goal had been to massacre people, there wouldn't have been 200 prisoners of war. They would have been gunned down on the spot, which they weren't, and 700 fled. Even Palestinian historians in the last few decades have come to the conclusion that there was absolutely, of course, no rape and nothing of the sort. Shortly thereafter, of course, Ben-Gurion in May 1948 is going to declare the Jewish state. Begin, not surprisingly, is out of hiding at that point. He'd been out of hiding for about a month, but he's certainly not invited to the ceremony in Tel Aviv at what is today called Independence Hall and what was then called the Tel Aviv Museum of Art. Interestingly enough, that night, or the next night in Begin's case, because it was Friday night, he and Ben-Gurion both wrote in their diaries. And they both wrote, amazingly, that when the state was declared on Friday morning, May 14th, 1948, people were dancing in the streets, and we've all read the stories. If you haven't read Amos Oz's narrative about this in A Tale of Love and Darkness, it's worth the whole price of the book just for those few pages. Neither Ben-Gurion nor Begin found themselves able to go out and dance. And they both wrote in their diaries that while the people were dancing, they knew what was coming. They knew that the war was now about to enter a much, much, much more dangerous and bloody phase. And before that war is over, 1% of the civilian Jewish population of the world is going to be killed. Think about what that would mean in America today, 3.3, 3.4 million people. 1% is going to be killed. But we'll come to that next time. In the meantime, as soon as the country is declared, Begin announces the formation of his political party, the Chirut Party, which will eventually morph into the Likud. And long before Begin will actually become the head of the Likud, a tremendous amount will happen in his career. The first major event will be the beginning of what is actually a small civil war in Israel's history in July 1948. And that's where we're going to pick things up next time. Ben-Gurion in 1965 gave an interview about the Altalena. And the evidence was overwhelming that Menachem Begin had been telling the truth. The evidence was overwhelming that David Ben-Gurion knew that Menachem Begin was telling the truth. And to the reporter who was interviewing him, what David Ben-Gurion says was, "Perhaps I was mistaken."